I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Steve Gill, the co-head of M&A and Capital Markets at Vinson & Elkins in Houston. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, David. Appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast, a little bit about your background, how you ended up at V&E. You were an associate in an eventful period that began with 9/11 and then toward the end of your years as an associate ended with the great financial crisis. And then in addition to being co-head of M&A and capital markets, you were also one of the hiring partners at V&E during COVID. So we'll talk a little bit about what you and the firm learned from that experience. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to practice corporate law.
Sure. So I've been in Houston my whole career, but I actually never stepped foot in the city until the fall of 1999 when I interviewed at V&E. I actually grew up in New Jersey. And when I got out of high school, I went to Rutgers University. And at Rutgers, that's where I met my now wife, who is from Louisiana. Needless to say that at Rutgers, a Louisiana girl stood out. And so we started dating and things got serious. She's older than me. So when she graduated, she went back to Louisiana to go to law school at LSU. And since we were pretty serious at the time, I decided to do a semester student exchange at LSU for the fall semester. LSU was a really cool place. It was football season. They have a great football team, as you know, down there. The tailgating and all the pageantry, it was eye-opening. If you ever do get an occasion to take in an LSU football game in the fall, I highly recommend it.
Oh, I've done it. It's an experience.
It is. I've taken friends from all over the world there, and they're always blown away. So just a little tip for my LSU friends there to definitely take that in. But at any rate, we were pretty serious. I loved being down in the South. I loved being at LSU. The weather was great. And so I ended up finishing up at LSU. I decided to full-time transfer. And I'm pretty convinced, David, that when I applied to law schools, I applied to a lot of schools, but obviously to LSU and to Tulane, and LSU law knew that I was from New Jersey, not an in-state resident. And I'm pretty sure that Tulane thought, because I went to LSU, that I was. Back then, I think, I don't know if they still have this now, but they had a program where they wanted 20% of the class to be from Louisiana. And so I ended up getting almost a full ride scholarship to Tulane. And so it was actually much cheaper to go to the private school Tulane than it was to go to the public school LSU. And so I ended up going to Tulane. And since I thought at the time we were talking about marriage at that point and the like, and since I thought at that time I'd end up in New Orleans, that made all the sense in the world.
And so then how did you end up in Houston?
So after my first year at Tulane, I interned at two great New Orleans firms, and they both made me offers to come back the next summer. And I only had to come back for a couple of weeks at each. This is, I think, unique to some of the law firms in the South at that time, where you could split your summers between firms. That's not the case anymore. That's one of the things where I think the whole country now, most people are summer associates at one firm, but back then you could split. And so my wife had a classmate who was a first-year associate at V&E, and she kept talking to me. She's like, man, I think you would fit in here great. You really should check it out. And so I decided to do that. I interviewed, like I said, in fall of 99, I came in, and Houston was vibrant. I really enjoyed my time there, and I convinced my wife that, like, they're paying a lot more in Houston than they are in New Orleans, so maybe I should at least take a flyer on this. And I came out the summer of 2000, started work, and just fell in love with it. The people here were amazing. The work was far more sophisticated than what I was seeing in New Orleans, Houston being the energy capital of the world, all the Fortune 500 companies, and V&E being the top firm in the town. It was fantastic. So after a while, I knew I had to start bargaining with my wife about uprooting and moving 350 miles west from New Orleans. But ultimately, that's probably the first negotiation I ever won with her. And when they made the offer, we've been out here since the fall of 2001 and have been at V&E ever since.
So talk about starting as an associate in 2001, which was a period of recession in the economy.
Yeah, it was well, let's start with the fact that my first day at V&E was September 10th, 2001. And we all know what happened the next day, my second day of work. I think I recall I was in some sort of computer training with all the new first year associates, and they got on the loudspeaker and said there's been an event and we're evacuating the building. And, you know, at the time, nobody knew the extent of the attack, and Houston having a lot of energy companies that we thought it could be a target. So basically downtown Houston evacuated. And for the remainder of that week, and I think into the next week, nobody came into the office. So that was, I guess, the first time that I ever had to do the work from home thing, and didn't really have to do that again, I guess, for another 20 years until COVID hit.
And then talk about your time as an associate and then the great financial crisis in 2008, which was obviously unsettling for everybody.
Yeah, that's right. Well, before 2008, V&E back in the early 2000s, our largest client was Enron. And I remember signing in. So we had 9/11 happen. And then once we get back to work, we're working on all these deals. I actually wasn't working on any Enron deals at the time, but we started hearing concern about Enron. And shortly after coming back from Thanksgiving, Enron files for bankruptcy, and there's a lot of consternation and whatnot. I do credit, because at the time I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm a kid from New Jersey. I'm down here in Houston. I don't know anybody really except for the people at the firm. I mean, did I make the wrong decision here? Should I go back and join my classmates up in New York and the like and be an M&A person up there? But I do credit two managing partners. There was a transition going on at the firm from Harry Reasoner to Joe Dilg, and they were very steadying in that time. It did help that Enron, even though they were our largest client, was less than 5% of the firm's revenue. And it also helped that Enron did shop to a lot of law firms. So a lot of the more aggressive structures they were doing were actually things that we didn't work on, but we became a little bit of in the crosshairs. And I remember Joe Dilg had to go in front of Congress, but he was an incredible steadying force and we got through it. You know, for the first part of my career, that's when the shale revolution in energy really kicked off. And I was doing mostly capital markets at the time. We did a ton of IPOs, taking all sorts of companies public. And I remember it was June and July of 2007, one of the busiest times of my life, because I was doing an IPO for an independent energy company and we were selling Huntsman at the same time. And so it was an incredibly busy time, but we first sold Huntsman to LyondellBasell, and then Apollo, who was the number two bidder, they jumped it. So we actually had the topping bid that we concern ourselves so much of when we're negotiating public M&A deals. And we ended up going to the Apollo deal. And then, of course, as you alluded to, the financial crisis hit. We signed that up, I want to say it was July of 2007. There was some antitrust concern, so it took a little bit of time. But by early 2008, the credit markets were in crisis. And Apollo obviously got cold feet. I distinctly remember the partner on that, Jeff Floyd, who was my mentor growing up. He and I got a call that the Huntsman team was flying into Houston because there was some concern and some rumors they were hearing. And so we drove out to, there's a private airport close by, Hobby Airport down here. And we drove out there and met them in a conference room at that FBO, and that's where they got the call from Apollo that they were backing out, that they thought there was an MAE had occurred because Huntsman's business had not performed up to the projections. And that kicked off about a 4-month sprint where we had to defend the deal, much like Twitter had to defend Elon Musk backing out. And so I went from being a capital markets lawyer to an M&A lawyer in that period. And then for about 4 months, I effectively was co-opted to the litigation group who was defending the merger agreement that really Jeff and I had a small part in drafting. And so we spent a lot of time going through helping draft the briefs. And then the trial happened pretty quick. I think they attempted to back out in the summer. We had the trial in early September in 2008.
And the trial was in the Delaware Court of Chancery before then Vice Chancellor Steve Lamb, correct?
That's right. That's right. We spent 8 days holed up at the Hotel DuPont in the basement. Everybody was doubled up in offices, and it was kind of a surreal experience for a couple of reasons. One, I'm not a litigator, but I was watching all that take place and then watching the contract that we wrote get ripped apart and figure out, like, what did you mean by this and the like. And so advising on all that. But it was also the Republican National Convention was going on, and John McCain was about to be the nominee. And all of a sudden, we woke up one morning and somebody named Sarah Palin was the vice president nominee. Nobody knew who that was. But of course, we're so busy with the trial, we're not even noticing all this going on. And then I get a call from my wife, and she's like, you know, there's a hurricane coming into Houston right now. And I frankly had no idea. We were just working nonstop on the trial. And she's like, well, I'm going to go see your parents up in the Philadelphia area, and maybe I'll get down to Delaware if you can ever break free. I did get one night free with her. They let me off for one night to go have dinner with her while we were doing the trial. But yeah, so we had an 8-day trial, and it was incredible. And of course, the decision comes out shortly thereafter, and it was a complete victory. And it was really kind of an affirming thing because it was our contract that was being tested. And they found that there wasn't an MAE, that Apollo had acted in bad faith. And they, interestingly, because a recent decision came out about what we call Con Ed language, damages for premium, we had a provision in there that said that in the event they committed a willful breach, we could seek those types of damages. And so Vice Chancellor Lamb, in his opinion, noted that while he wasn't passing on that, that there was a contractual provision that could open them up to large damages. And so that happens. We end up settling it ultimately. Business exigencies took over, and Huntsman ultimately settled by basically providing a preferred to Apollo on some very good terms for Huntsman. And I think it was a multi-billion dollar investment. But yeah, that was a defining moment of my career as an associate.
And how did, if at all, being involved in litigation of that intensity change how you approach being an M&A lawyer? Because after that, of course, litigation is no longer a theoretical possibility. It's something you've experienced.
Yeah, I mean, like, what do they say, that the generals are always fighting the last war? I think what it does in a broad sense, it makes you realize how important the words matter. A lot of practitioners, I think a lot of our investment banking brethren seem to think that, you know, public M&A merger agreements are pretty tried and true. There's, you change this, you change that. But by and large, it's the same script. There's not much art or science to it, and nothing could be further from the truth. And I think it does make you just much more careful in how you're drafting the provisions that you're drafting, particularly if you're drafting things that haven't been interpreted by the court. Like, one of the provisions in there that Vice Chancellor Lamb had to address was this a knowing and intentional breach by Apollo? And that had never been interpreted before. Now, in all the merger agreements, we have defined knowing and material or knowing and intentional breach somewhat out of that case. So yeah, the attention to detail and really making sure you're not just viewing third-party beneficiary language, the specific performance language, as mere boilerplate, but rather things that could be very important if things go awry in the transaction.
And then you become a partner in 2010. Much of the economy is in a recession that lasts for several years, but in the energy sector, shale is really beginning to boom.
Yeah. I don't want to say we were immune, because the year I made partner was 2009, the year after the Huntsman case. And I was the only one that made partner. So there was an economic hit that was felt even in Houston, even in the energy space. But you're right. The number of companies that went public from 2009 to about, we had a little downturn in 2014, but even through 2018 or so, was incredible. And a lot of that had to do with the influence of private equity. As we all know, private equity has a life cycle, and they have really one of two outcomes. They're either going to take the company, the portfolio company, build it up and take it public, or they're going to sell it. And so there was a nice symbiotic nature with the practice that we had at V&E. We had a large number of private equity firms, particularly on the energy side, or even larger firms that used us for their energy transactions. And our capital markets teams were going bonkers taking these companies public, but the M&A side would also have to be there for the sales and that, the exits on that. And sometimes the companies would go public and then sell. So we did a number of deals like that. We did Memorial selling to Range. We did Rice EQT, RSP Concho. We did just a ton of smaller independent companies merging or acquisitions. And it was really a very interesting time in the energy space and a lot of activity.
And then again, over the course of your career, when you started practice in 2001, private equity was almost a niche business and it didn't seem to have much of a presence in energy. Whereas in the last 10 years, energy has become a huge area of investment for private equity sponsors. Talk about how that change has affected your practice and the practice in Houston generally.
Yeah, I think that's the key. So Houston, when I started in 2001, had a bunch of, let's call them indigenous firms, V&E being one, you have Baker Botts, it used to be called Fulbright and Jaworski. You had Houston firms, and there wasn't, Skadden had a presence in Houston, but it was a real small office. So you had kind of, I don't want to ever say boutique, because Baker Botts, V&E, we now have national and international offices, but it was a little bit of a regional aspect to it. Private equity started looking at energy right before the shale revolution started. And we had a number of partners, including our now chairman, Keith Fullenweider, who saw what that was about to become. And Keith, when he first made partner, was a capital markets lawyer. And he saw that where private equity was going, and he quickly shifted that and started developing the relationships he had with the TPGs and the KKRs and the Blackstones. And really, we went into private equity as a firm pretty heavily. And some of our other, what we considered our peers at the time, really didn't. They had large Fortune 500 companies. They were corporate firms. We invested way more into private equity. And so when you had the national firms start coming, beginning with Latham, right about the time I made partner when Latham came in, they certainly all picked off a little bit of V&E talent, but they were able to come into town and really pick off a lot of talent from some of our competitors who were less invested in private equity. And with all the activity being the shale revolution, largely driven by portfolio companies of private equity, that's where the work was. And so we were relatively stable while other firms were struggling with the impact of all these national firms, starting with Latham and then Kirkland and Gibson Dunn moving into town. And I think when you sit there and you look at the market dynamics now, with all those national firms having a really strong presence and being desirable, but V&E still remaining to be the place of destination for talent, particularly in the energy space, I think that kind of tells the story. It was our investment in the private equity that really was the smart play and ultimately led to our success today.
When you were a hiring partner at V&E, how did you see that change in the market affect the competition for talent in law schools, and then how you had to think about retaining your best lawyers?
Yeah, sure. So I became the hiring partner at the end of 2019, and I was planning for a summer like any other, where you have all these events and a lot of in-person and Astros games or Yankee games up in New York and parties and whatnot, and also kind of doing the structure of the deal. And then, of course, COVID comes in and completely changes everything. At the same time, Latham was always pretty successful, but it was near that time that Kirkland was really starting to get a footing, in large part because of the bankruptcies that were also happening at the same time. They've got a really strong bankruptcy shop, and obviously they've got a very strong private equity practice. And those two things were helping them kind of become supercharged. And so you did find yourself competing for talent where you used to compete against the indigenous firms. You're now competing with the Lathams, the Kirklands, and then I think Gibson sprouted up. And it really made us change a lot of the ways that we thought about recruiting. One of the changes I implemented as hiring partner was to, you know, we always focus on the second years because they have to get the job. It used to be like you would have maybe 10 first year associates throughout the country that would work. It was just a very small program. What I decided to do was start investing more in the first years and developing those relationships up front. Whether you ended up hiring them or not, you could always come around, and since you've already established the relationship, even if you didn't have a spot for them, you were somebody familiar and they were comfortable with you when you went on campus when they were second years. But if you got them to come as first years and they had a good time, and people tend to come to this firm and have a good time and feel like it's a good place to start their career, then they'll come back their second year. And if they come back their second year, then they're not available to your competitors, if you think about it in those terms. And so we went from having a very small 1L program to now I think we probably have about 50-50 1Ls to 2Ls. That was one of the big changes we made. And I think that was somewhat driven by the national firms coming to town.
And then how did COVID affect how you approach recruiting as a firm?
Yeah, so again, I was preparing for a great summer, and then we had to shift gears. Obviously, with hindsight, some of the things you wish you would have just said, okay, it's not going to happen. But we held out hope all along the way that we would maybe by the summer be able to be in person. So we pushed back our start date. We did make, I think, a smart decision to tell the folks that were law students coming to us that we were going to pay them the full 13 weeks or 10 weeks, whatever they had signed up for. We were going to pay them regardless of how long or short our program was, because I know a lot of them are somewhat dependent on that for their education and expenses. But we ended up doing a shortened period. It was all remote. We had events. We did online wine tasting, online cooking classes. But I think people appreciated it. I think we did our best to try to develop the relationships that the folks that had come before them always got during the summer. Obviously, we couldn't replicate it, but I think we did a pretty good job. And we ended up with a very high acceptance rate that summer. And a lot of the folks are still with us now. They're mid-level associates now. But what that did to change things is we did all realize how we could recruit without necessarily having to travel. We still go on campus nowadays. We still go to OCIs or on-ground interviews at kind of our main feeder schools. But it did open us up to a lot of schools that it wasn't worth it to go there to get one person and send a whole team. But now we can do it via Zoom. We can do it remotely. And so I think we've actually been able to broaden the number of law schools that we recruit from, or at least we do try to recruit people that have an obvious connection to either the firm or the city that they're interested in. But it has made that a much easier job.
Talk about your role as co-head of M&A and capital markets and what you're seeing in your own practice now.
Sure. So I've been in this position now for about 2 years, and we have over 200 lawyers in the M&A capital markets group. And so we divided up between three co-heads, myself and Sarah Morgan here in Houston and John Grand in Dallas. And it's a good group because Sarah is very capital markets focused and energy transition focused. I'm public M&A, do a little bit of activism work. And then John is private equity focused. And so we kind of cover the spectrum of partners and associates that are in our group. Our job is to help think strategically about finding opportunities for business development, growing demand, and also we schedule periodic meetings to make sure our partners are staying on top of all the things that are happening, all the developments in the law. A lot of times you get busy working on your transactions and things pop up, and it's good to have these periodic meetings where you talk about developments and bring in outside specialists and the like and educate the partners. And then, of course, the other thing that we are is we manage our associate talent pool, like if we need to do an additional hiring, when to do the additional hiring, making sure we're appropriately staffed for the level of work that we have. And then we are the first screen for the partnership admissions process.
Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in your own practice now and deals you've worked on or are working on that are particularly noteworthy.
Yeah. So right now we are seeing it's interesting because it ties into a trend, but we are seeing a consolidation wave in energy. We had a number, particularly in the upstream space, but what happens in upstream trickles down, right? And so we've had a number of deals that started really with a midstream deal that we weren't involved with, but then we sold Denbury to Exxon. Exxon did the Pioneer deal. We represented Crown Rock in its sale to Oxy. We were involved in the Endeavor transaction. And so you're seeing this consolidation, and then it goes even smaller. You had the Callon deal and the Chevron Hess deal. So you're seeing this consolidation in upstream at the same time where you have an FTC that is particularly concerned about consolidation and its impact on competition. And so the big deals, the Chevron Hess, the Crown Rock Oxy, and the Exxon Pioneer deal are all now in second requests with the FTC. And we're working through that. Some of the smaller deals we've noticed have not gotten the same scrutiny. And there may even be a basin specific thing. So the deals that are happening in the Permian, which are all three of the big ones, and some smaller ones are getting hung up. Whereas, you know, we did Chord and Enerplus, which was in the Bakken. We got out in the typical 30-day waiting period. So it used to be when you were thinking about an oil and gas deal, there wasn't a lot of attention given to antitrust because unless you were going to be 30% or more of the basin, it didn't really, you know, ever seem to be a problem to get out in the initial 30 days. That 30% rule is gone. And so we're all having to adjust to it. It's definitely changing the length of time that deals are taking to close. And so that's all part of the deal-making process and managing clients on that and how antitrust provisions from 5 years ago are just completely different today.
It would seem to be a central issue on many of the deals that you and lawyers whose client focuses in other sectors work on.
Yeah, one buddy of mine at a New York firm said, well, welcome to the party. We've been dealing with this in my industry for years. But I think the FTC, just as a general matter, is definitely more heavily regulating these things. And I don't necessarily think that a change in the administration, I think there would be noticeable differences, but it's not like we're going back to 2018 again, where there's just very little concern about it in certain industries. I think antitrust regulation will be something that people are going to be dealing with for the next foreseeable future, for the next decade.
And then finally, tell us a little bit about how you decompress from work.
Yeah, sure. So my wife and I have two kids, and I made myself a promise, actually before we even got married, but we were dating at the time. I had decided I wanted to do three things. If I did these three things in life, everything would be a success. One, I wanted to be really good at what I did. And I didn't even know at the time when I did this that I was going to be a lawyer, but I think I've done pretty well there. I wanted to be a good husband, and you can ask my wife to check me on that, but I think I've done a good job there. And I also wanted to be a really good dad. I had great parents, and it was important to me that even though I was doing a job that does require a lot of time, a lot of travel, a lot of late nights, I made the time to make sure I was always present there. Tried to make it to every T-ball game, every ballet recital, all those types of things. And I wasn't perfect, but I did a pretty good job there. We traveled the world with both of our kids. My daughter is now a junior at UCLA, so we don't see her as much, but my son's a senior and he's about to go off to college. So we're about to be empty nesters, even though I'm not even 50. But most of the stuff was done around the kids. And my son and I do share an affinity for football. He's a terrific football player. He's going to play in college. And so the last couple of years, most of it was going and watching him do his thing and go watch him play, do the trainings, go to the college camps, compete at showcases and the like. And it's been a really cool time. And yeah, sometimes you have to sit in the bleachers and with a merger agreement in your hand and mark it up while you're watching them do their drills and whatnot. But it has kept us close and it's something that's always grounded me. So I'm going to have to get a hobby. David, I'm probably going to try to take golf back up. I played a lot in law school and I was starting to get pretty good. And then the kids came and that went away. But yeah, I'm going to probably try to take up golf here once he goes away this fall.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
for Drinks with a Deal. I'm David Marcus.